So thank you so much for having me here again and my friends here to join you for worship. It's a great privilege to be able to be here with you. And thank you to all of you who made this happen. You know, these things don't come together in 10 minutes beforehand, though it may have looked like we were trying to do that. It takes much planning. So as Reverend Roger mentioned, you know, I've been working for the last couple of years for the UUA as a Congregational Life staff person. And basically what that means is that I travel around the Pacific Central District, which you're all a part of. And my understanding of my job, I'm not sure it's my supervisor's understanding of it, but mine is that I sort of try to discern what needs to be talked about, and then I talk about it. And one of the things that I've really noticed, especially over the last year, is that, I mean, I think it's really important to talk about trust. There is so much mistrust, not just in our world, but really right in our own UU faith. It's astounding. We mistrust each other, we mistrust ministers, we mistrust the congregational board because they, you know what they don't even know what, you know, even though we were just on the board last week, we still mistrust them, you know. And never mind how we mistrust the UUA and all those people in Boston, they don't know what they're doing, you know. I think actually when you look at a lot of problems that happen in congregations, budget issues, you know, or issues about, you know, any major decision, if you go deep enough, you find that trust is underneath. And I think there's a couple of reasons for this. I mean, one is that I think we tend to be so wedded sometimes to our own agendas and our own vision and our way of seeing things that we can't imagine that someone could see it differently. And so if we do see that, then we assume they must be either nuts or they're trying to undermine us, right? That's one possibility. The other possibility is just, of course, habit. You know, we learned a long time ago in the 60s to question authority. And sometimes I think we haven't stopped to question since then whether that still makes sense in this given situation. But I'm not going to talk about that level of trust right now, because just 2 weeks ago at District Assembly, we had an hour and a half program where we really got into this. I'm going to try to take it one level deeper and talk about kind of the fundamental nature of trust. Because really, I think the deeper purpose of my being a UUA staff member is not to come and tell you what you need to hear, but to be with you on the journey. And I think that this thing about trust and how we can nurture it and what it is and when it makes sense, that's something we all have to deal with. And I'm in it as much as you. And one of the things I want to say about it, I think, is that the thing about trust is that it's both a practical issue, you know, and a spiritual issue. It's practical because you can't cross the street fundamentally without having some sort of trust that your calculations about when that car is going to get here are accurate, right? And it's a spiritual issue because it connects almost instantly to our deepest held beliefs. And I say this whether you're a humanist or not, we all have beliefs about, is the universe a benevolent place or a hostile place or an indifferent place? Can I be a part of this and trust that there's a wisdom greater than me? So, as Steve Martin used to say, let's start. You know, what is trust? You know, I mean, if you think about it from the very beginning, you know, developmental psychology tells us that trust, you know, at the very earliest levels of life is just, I mean, it's essential. It's a survival trait. I mean, you can't be so overwhelmed with anxiety that you think you're going to die every time your parent leaves the room, right? You have to develop some sort of sense that even though they're leaving, they will come back. And even though there's inconsistency in parenting always, because parents are human and they don't do the things we want them to do often, we all have to kind of find a way. And we know when that trust is broken and betrayed in abuse or neglect or simple human inconsistency, there's a cost that can take many, many years to get over. So I think that in childhood, our concept of trust that develops is all about reliability and dependability of those around us. Because we're helpless when we're children in some ways. We need the support of adults. But I think what happens is as we grow older, we've got to shift that. We need to shift it from this over-focus on what's around us and whether it's going to turn out the way we want, and shift it to something more internal. And I think the reason for this is kind of obvious. I mean, if you hang your trust on whether everything externally is going to be okay, you're really going to get disappointed. You know, any of you who are getting older, you know what I'm talking about? Your body is going to betray you. It's just going to do, you can eat right, you can go macrobiotic, you can go probiotic, you can drink green juice, it doesn't matter. You're going to get older and things are going to fall apart. That's the way it goes, you know? That's why in the song we just sang, you know, it has that line we so much love. You know, when my friends do me wrong, I shake it off and go on. Not when my enemies do me wrong, and not if my friends do me wrong, but when my friends do me wrong, because that's, we do that to each other. You know, we do stuff to each other, sometimes out of ill will, but sometimes out of just being thoughtless. And so if we hang our sense of trust on whether the people around us do exactly what we want, we're going to be disappointed. You know, and never mind the chaos in the world, you know, riots and racism and earthquakes and all of the chaos that happens that either randomly or systematically, in the case of racism, you know, affects people. If we can't rely on that. And even, I mean, let's go one level higher, even at the greatest level, right? Entropy. Things are flying apart all the time. That's kind of the way things go. So if trust is going to be about the external world, I think we're going to be in trouble. But the thing is, it isn't the whole story. Because there is, you know, there is entropy. There is this kind of tendency of things to fall apart. But there is also a self-organizing force in the universe, which is life, which is consciousness. You know, it brings things together in the face of the tendency to fall apart. It's pretty amazing, actually. And so what I want to ask is the question, what would it mean if we opened the door to basing our trust on that process rather than on that one? So let me give you a basic example. I've been thinking about it lately, and I've decided that I have no interest in dying. Not now, not ever, really. You know, there's too much to do in the world. You know, there's too many foods to try and songs to sing and places to go and people like you to meet. I mean, what's the point? I don't want to do that. Now, I don't lay awake at night a lot thinking about dying, although it happens. But everything around me tells me that dying is inevitable, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm quite powerless around that. So, how does my capacity to trust relate to that? How's it going to help me? And what I think is, you know, what if I kind of think about dying in a way that isn't about losing, but is about living? You know, I mean, I can imagine living, and I hope I do it at times, living in a way that really trusts my capacity to connect with people, to reach out, to make meaning out of the things that happen, to be creative. You know, I can kind of imagine that, you know, if I have the luxury, whenever it happens, of kind of having a little reflection before I die, I can imagine being able to say, wow, you know, this isn't all just about loss. This is about life, you know, with all of that feeling that I've developed by connecting with people. And it feels, I don't know, it feels good in my heart to think about it that way. So in this version of trust, you know, what it would be about is like no longer about you and more be about my inner life. But I think we still have to kind of pull this apart a little more. I mean, so what would it mean? Would it mean like, you know, let's just live as though everything is fine and nothing outside matters? You know, that's not going to work, right? I mean, I don't think ignorance is bliss. I have a friend who says, the unexamined life is worth living. I don't agree with him on that. You know, I think, you know, the thing is, I think when we're in denial about things, when we just try to shut ourselves up in a bubble and not really worry about what's happening, it eats at our soul. Because as human beings, we're too conscious for that. I mean, you really have to drug yourself up pretty heavily with alcohol or drugs or work or Netflix or whatever your chosen drug of choice is to deaden yourself enough to be separate from the suffering in the world. So living in a way that's out of step with reality, I think, is not going to make it. So I would never advocate, you know, blind trust. Instead, and this is the only time in my life I will ever agree with anything Ronald Reagan said. But you know, when he used to go to those talks with Mikhail Gorbachev, he used to always repeat that Russian proverb. Gorbachev apparently got really, really irritated at this. But he used to always repeat, "Доверяй, но проверяй," which is a Russian proverb that means trust, but verify. And Reagan was talking about nuclear arms reductions at the time. I'm not talking about that, but I think it plays the same way here. But you have to listen to the proverb. You know, when you're talking about trust, what you do is you trust and then verify. The problem with us, I think, in our culture is that we try to verify before we will trust. You know, and that's like trying to fly the airplane without letting go of it first. You know, I'm going to make sure this thing is exactly the way I want it. Well, there's no way to make it fly if you're not willing to let go of it at some point. So that's the kind of thing like in a relationship. I'm going to trust you that you'll be good and you'll never betray me, but I do want access to all of your email and to your text and your phone at every moment, right? And then I'll trust you, right? You know, trust actually doesn't work that way. It works the other way around. Now, it's natural for us to want to do that. That's human, but that's not trust. The problem with all of this is that our natural tendency as human beings, when faced with a life that brings fear and anxiety and illness and all of those things, is that we try to control it and make sure it only goes the way we want. And that is doomed to fail. Because the extent to which we're in control of our lives, even for those of us who are as privileged as those of us in the room, even for us at the really, really top of the kind of socioeconomic spectrum, our degree to control ourselves is our lives is so much less than we think. So the question is, how do we do this then? How do we nurture this inner trust? And I guess the way I would think about it is there's several levels. The first level, most superficial level, is kind of like, I can trust that if things come up, I'll deal with it. You know, I'll figure out a way. Like, you know, God forbid you get a cancer diagnosis. If that's happened to you, you know. This is one of the most terrifying things that can happen in life. Once you get it, well, then it becomes a problem to be solved or to be worked with anyway. So you kind of take, okay, well, all right, I'm going to pick myself up and kind of do what I need to do. So that's a kind of a trust at that level. Sort of like the serenity prayer that Alcoholics Anonymous uses, Reinhold Niebuhr's serenity prayer. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I actually like the Calvin and Hobbes version too, which is, I want the strength to change what I can, the inability to accept what I can't, and the incapacity to tell the difference. That's sort of the American version of that. So, I mean, the part of the wisdom that has to be developed here is the capacity, clearly, to discern what we can work with and what we can't, right? What we can change and what we can't. Then at the next level, I think that there's a level of trust where you kind of say to yourself, okay, even if I do stuff that's kind of bizarre or dumb, I make mistakes, because we all do that, I will eventually kind of self-correct, you know, because there'll be feedback. Reverend Roger mentioned the reorganization of the UUA staff. This is utterly irrelevant to you. You don't need to know about it. But within the staff, people went crazy on this, freaking out. Oh my God, that's a good, you know, without any sense that they're, if we're going in the wrong direction, you know, we'll sort it out because we will get feedback from the environment. Now, you see a lot of this in religious traditions in the world. There's a version of Hinduism where the concept is that there's something called the Shakti. And the Shakti is a sort of awakened, alive, creative, spiritual energy. And once it's awakened in you, then no matter what you do, you're always going to get brought back to the path. You can try to stray away, but it's going to come back at you. The universe will bring you back. And you may have heard Christians talking in the same way, that, you know, there's a path for me, and when I don't go on it, I get the feedback. It's conceptualized as God in that case, but it's the same idea. Now, I don't think of it theologically in either of those ways, but I get the idea that really we do have wisdom to pay attention to our actions in the world. So if we go through life like this, trying not to pay attention to anything, well, that's one thing, but that takes a lot of energy. if we open up, yeah, we can sense, yep, this is the path, or whoops, that was really a wrong move. And then the next level under that, I think, is the one where I say, okay, you know, I may not have the capacity to deal with anything that comes up, and I may be just too blind to what's happening in the world to get the feedback, but you know, there's a wisdom out there that maybe I can draw on that isn't about me. In a congregation, this has to do with opening up to the wisdom of the collective. You know, that maybe there are things that other people can see that you can't. Even though your vision is this, it may be that there's more happening than you know. This is kind of like trusting the process. And I have a slightly mixed response to trusting the process. On the one hand, I'm a big fan because it's how I live my life. Roger mentioned, you know, I was a psychology professor out in Allegheny College in Pennsylvania for 18 years. And then it just seemed like I started giving away stuff. And I started just kind of getting rid of as much stuff as I could. I started replacing stuff in my house, knowing that it would be for the people who rented it after me. And then this job came up and I came here because it felt like where I needed to be. Now, 2 years later, it seems like, well, I need to be back there again. I haven't a clue as to why this is, either of these. But I sort of trust that there's a wisdom that's operating that I can listen to and that I can follow in a certain way and not have to worry about it all being under my control. That's not blind trust. You know, I pay attention to the feedback that comes to me. Like in my past, I don't know if you've ever had this happen. Have you ever had the example where you try over and over and over to do something, like apply for a certain kind of job? And you get one rejection after another, after another, after, it's, you know, after 6 or 8 of those, you might get the point. Wow, this one isn't for me. Unless you're J.K. Rowling, of course. And you go to 100 publishers and then you publish Harry Potter. So the other side of the trusting in the process is that, you know, actually it's quite hard. Because there's a lot of stuff happening in the world that's very hard to deal with. I mean, can I trust that somehow the earthquake in Nepal has any kind of meaning at all? I mean, it seems like a random event. So I can't go quite to the form of saying, well, there's a plan and this is part of the plan. That doesn't make any sense to me. But what does make sense to me is that sense that, you know, maybe my own vision isn't the only vision. And maybe I can trust that there are people and there are institutions and there is a universe that I can draw on to help me decide where to go. And I think really that's kind of where it goes. At a certain level of this, when you get to kind of the basic level, it stops being about, all right, I'm going to verify this. This is the right thing. This is the wrong thing. It stops being about questions like, you know, is there some sort of deity? Or is there meaning or purpose in life? Because we will never know the answers to those questions. When you get to this level, it becomes a choice where you get to decide, am I going to live my life as though it has meaning or am I not? Nobody gets to make that decision for you. Only you can do it. So I'm not going to tell you what you should do. But I will just tell you briefly about why I've decided to say yes to that kind of life, which I would say, even, I know it's a dangerous word in this kind of context, why I would say yes to a life, and why I do say yes to a life of faith. And to me, I mean, at the basic level, first of all, it just makes logical sense. You know, I mean, look around for just 1 second. Look around, see these people in here. Just turn, look around. I know it's kind of weird. I can see these people. These people around you, are the most miraculous, complex thing that I know of in the universe. You know, yes, there are galaxies, there are quasars and black holes, and there are mountains and valleys, and some of them are beautiful and some of them are very complex, but they don't have a fraction of the complexity and creativity that any one of you has. So, I think that It's very clear that there's something going on here that I will never understand. I don't know what it means, but our existence is a miracle. So it's amazing and it's humbling. Why not take that as the foundation of my life? It's a miracle that we're here at all and that we can look at each other and see each other. And then that's the intellectual reason. Then there's the practical reason. It's just much easier to live life. You know, when you live life trying, and I've tried it, I'm telling you, I live from experience here. When you live life trying to, like, for example, manipulate how everybody else sees you so that they like you, it's exhausting. Yes, I mean, it is so, and you lay awake at night, you worry, oh my God, I said that thing, and now what are they going to do now? And oh my God, you know, it's like in the story, you know. If I were to live all that year in the elementary school classroom being panicked that these kids are going to hate me if I say the wrong thing, I mean, what kind of a life is that? Think of how that siphons your energy. But if you live a life where you say, wow, you know, there are mysteries around me that I have no comprehension of, and I have an integral place in it. I may not know what that place is, but I'm as much a feature of this life as any other person, as any other object, as any other place. So that's the kind of thing. I mean, that frees me up so much. It means I can go and I can, you know, the thing about the greeting everybody, that stuff is so hard for me, actually. You know, I've always had a hard time meeting people I don't know. But with this kind of life, you can go up and you can just say, wow, look, there's a person. I wonder who's there. Here I am. You know, it makes it so we can sing, you know, songs that have all this theology in it that I don't necessarily buy into. But it doesn't matter because it's not about that. It's about the offering that we're making. I know I have something to offer. I offer the best I can. What you do with it, it's up to you. And I guess really, finally, the last thing is that living out that kind of life, to me, it lets me love better. You know, it gives me this kind of basis to connect with other people, with you, knowing that, you know, no matter how differently you look from me, you know, or no matter what your life experience is, you know, or what state you're in at the moment, I'm with a kindred spirit. You are, in every imaginable way, a child of God or of the universe. What's not to love in that? So I can look out and see every one of you here and have that opening. I mean, I'm not sure there's anything more in life that's more fun than that. So for me, I guess, you know, the bottom line is the path, the spiritual path, the humanist path, the path of life, whatever you want to call it, it's really ultimately about liberation. It's about freeing ourselves from the strictures that we put on ourselves and that people try to put on us so that we can really fulfill our purpose, which, as far as I can tell, is to love each other and to love this world. And to do as much good as we can, with as much humbleness as we can, and frankly, as much faith and trust as we can. So it is, and so may it be for you. Amen.